We start with a very brief roundup of the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch, read by First Watch's editor Amy Herman, and then we talk with Eric Kane about the strength of the evidence behind the VA's suicide prevention guidelines. Here's the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. A large meta-analysis finds that all types of menopausal hormone therapy, except vaginal estrogen, are associated with increased breast cancer risk. The risk appears to increase as the duration of use increases, and it persists even 10 years after treatment stops. Next, a randomized trial suggests that high-dose vitamin D supplements do not improve bone mineral density in healthy adults. In fact, higher doses, like 4,000 and 10,000 international units daily, might actually reduce bone density. Elsewhere, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force now says that all adults aged 18 to 79 should be screened for hepatitis C at least once. Previously, the group recommended screening only for high-risk adults and baby boomers. The new recommendation is still in draft form, however. Next, the CDC issued its flu vaccine recommendations for the upcoming flu season. Among the changes, the Afluria quadrivalent inactivated vaccine is now recommended for those aged 6 months and up. Previously, it was limited to those aged 5 years and older. And finally, in a study out of Arizona, 1 in 4 teens reported using potent cannabis concentrates at least once, and over 10% reported doing so in the past month. Cannabis concentrates can contain 3 times the amount of THC as traditional cannabis. And that's it for this week. Now on to Joe Ilia's latest clinical conversation.
This time we've got Eric Kane, whose editorial in the Annals of Internal Medicine posts some questions about the quality of the data supporting the latest suicide prevention guidelines from the Department of Veterans Affairs. I should add that he praises the guidelines as being, quotes, as good as one will now find in the United States. Dr. Kane is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester, where he also directs the Injury Control Research Center for Suicide Prevention. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Kane.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
What is the shape of suicide in the U.S. these days? It's gotten worse lately, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Unfortunately, it's been increasing in a rather steady fashion since 2000. And it's very clear that, by and large, it's hit mostly people in the 35 to 64-year-old age range, in part because that's the biggest chunk of the population. Mm-hmm. But also, that's really the area, both among men and women, where the rise has sort of been most dramatic and really pushed up the national rates as the rates in this group have gone up. Now, in recent years, we've also seen a rise in younger people, but that kind of came a little bit later.
Now, does that reflect what we're seeing among veterans?
Well, we have to sort of parse out the veteran rates, because there are really two ways to think about this. The first is certainly a big chunk of the veteran population is in the Veterans Health Administration. You know, it's an acute care or and a chronic care health system. The VHA has worked very hard. The Veterans Health Administration, I use the short VHA, has worked very hard to try to pull that rate down, and they've had some modest success at that. There's no question. But at the same time, the majority of veterans live outside of the VHA. They were not eligible for health benefits. They were in service, of course, but didn't have any service-related or service-connected issues, and live amongst the general population. And we've seen a tremendous increase in suicides among that group. And probably about 2/3 of all veteran suicides are, 50, 55 and upward. So that really parallels in part really two things. This chunk of the population we talked about, which has been really the drivers for increasing suicide, but also then the basically older white men. You know, older white men have very high suicide rates compared to any other group. You know, lots of the things that we see with older populations. And, a lot of these folks have ongoing chronic medical problems, especially, things like poorly treated pain or chronic pain or insomnia, as well as depression and other ails.
So the guidelines and the evidence base that you were talking about in your editorial, You, as I said, you praise the guidelines as the best available in this country right now. But you say, and I'm quoting you, we must be wary of this evidence and its implications. Why do you counsel wariness?
Well, you know, like a lot of literature reviews on which this was based, they go in and they dip into the literature and they try to find randomized controlled trials or large pharma trials or insurance-based databases. And these are, in some ways, not necessarily representative of the U.S. population. They're also not representative of the people who die by suicide, in the sense that, if you think about it, you know, about 3/4 of the people who die by suicide are men. Men don't volunteer as much for trials. And so we see in the psychotherapy trials that there's really a preponderance of women. Now, some involve men, but indeed, for instance, the dialectical behavioral therapy literature, which really started out of the University of Washington and Marsha Linehan, excellent quality research, but it was focused largely on women with borderline personality disorder. Now, that may be very useful for application with those folks, but it isn't necessarily going to be the kind of thing where you'd say, well, this is broadly applicable to the people who die by suicide. Another thing I pointed out in the editorial is that it's really hard to keep people in studies. You know, the attrition rate is just phenomenal in pharmaceutical studies, in psychotherapy studies. And when you have a lot of people dropping out, then you've got to be really cautious about how you interpret generalizability. So, you know, what I was basically saying about the guidelines is they're practical. Now, they're voluminous. You know, these algorithms are the kind of thing that, you know, if you can, well, as long as your eyes don't roll up as you read them and you can follow them through, they have some real practical sense to them. In primary care, obviously, there's a lot of now screening for depression and things like, you know, the PHQ-9 or the PHQ-2 or some of these other screening tools that have become very common. And clearly, you want to be alert to those and you want to ask for help when you need it. And obviously, if someone's got a milder depression, you know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, a lot of primary care docs feel capable of dealing with. But, you know, others say, hey, I want to get a consult or at least, you know, call up my colleagues in mental health fields and ask them some questions. More broadly, I think one of the things that is really clear when we look at the literature is that, especially with people over 50, the suicides come from populations of people with a lot of chronic ails. So what I basically say to clinicians, if you see somebody who you think life's a mess, even when they're not suicidal, that's a person you intervene with. You know, you see a lot of these folks in primary care where, you know, we understand that even when someone attempts suicide, most will die from other ails. You know, most will die from so-called natural causes that are related to some of the same health behaviors, health risks that the suicide folks die from.
Yeah, we've been talking about the practical aspects of these new guidelines. But one of the things that the United States, and we talked about the fact that the United States, the rate is going up. And so you have an interesting reference. It's the OECD data on countries in the OECD. Boy, there are some really shocking things. I think Lithuania and Korea are double and way above everyone else.
If you look at the OECD, you understand that there are some countries with rates that have skyrocketed and other countries where rates have plummeted. And it's really important to begin to try to understand what are the factors that are associated with those changes, because they teach us things. Overall, and this is beyond the OECD data, a decade or two decades ago, the World Health Organization estimated that there were about 1 million suicides a year. Now the estimate is that there's slightly less than 800,000. Suicide around the world is largely coming down. And it's coming down because of economic development in many countries, where what we might say is that there wasn't a suicide prevention program and the decline might be positive but incidental. There are other countries in the world where it's come down, Finland, Denmark, or we're say low, England, Austria, you know, other countries where we've seen improvements, where the improvement has been intentional, where they've intentionally initiated efforts. And then, of course, there are countries like Korea, where the suicide rate went up as the economy developed and as tremendous internal migration occurred. And what you saw in Korea, what colleagues and I have done some research on this, is we've seen a real disruption in a lot of the social structures and the sort of the cultural foundation of what held, you know, the country together, because people moved from rural to urban environments over a very short period of time, much shorter than, say, the U.S. in the early 20th century. But even in the early 20th century in the U.S., we saw the same kind of rise as you had this transformation. Japan had it in the 50s and 60s. So it's very clear that there are large forces that operate. And in the United States, people, and bringing it back to the U.S., you know, there's a lot of argument now, but many people think that the underpinnings of the suicides are broader social and economic issues. The, you know, sort of the loss of the many manufacturing communities, the loss of jobs, the displacement of people. And maybe they're working now, but they had a $28 an hour or $30 an hour job before. Now it's 11, you know, in a service industry. And some people have argued that suicide has hit much more for people with less education. You know, these are also the folks who have many of our chronic diseases. And so there's a real tie there. And it's really important for, you know, clinicians to be aware that especially men who are not always so forthcoming about their emotional state, that we talk to them not so much, how do you feel, but what are you doing? What's it like? Well, you know, oh, you've lost your job. You've been displaced. How are you adjusting? What's your day like? It's much more of getting into that, which will be revealing, than just asking somebody how they feel, because they'll, oh, fine. You know, things are good.
One of the things that comes up about the Second Amendment debate here is that, oh, gee, if there were so many deaths from guns, two-thirds of which, I believe, are suicides. And you mentioned Australia, and Australia over the past, I guess, 10, 15 years or more has restricted access or has discouraged access to firearms. And yet, their suicide rate has not reduced, really, has it?
Right. And, you know, firearms and the method of suicide is a really complex issue. And so I think we partly have to disentangle it. Clearly, there have been efforts to reduce suicide which have not involved firearm restriction. The Air Force in the late 1990s had a successful suicide prevention effort. And firearm restriction was not part of it. In the Israeli army, they, on the other hand, restricted soldiers from taking their guns home, and that actually helped with the suicide. And in Switzerland, as the number of soldiers decreased, you know, in Switzerland, the soldier had his gun at home, or her gun, but once the size of the Swiss army went down and the number of guns in homes went down as part of that, the suicide rate went down. So there are indicators that that's important. Now, in Australia in the mid-90s, there was this horrendous mass killing and a restriction on assault weapons and high capacity, you know, all the things that are being debated in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it looked for a while like suicide might be dipping, but it's been rising in the last few years. And this concerns people in Australia. I visited there this year. And clearly, it isn't rising on the back of firearms. It's rising on things like hanging. So there are other things around. Look at Finland. Finland is, you know, which has had a, you know, more than 50% reduction in suicide due to intentional efforts. It's clearly a gun culture. Mm. And you know, hunting is very big in Finland. Long guns are very big in that area. And it's very evident that they've been able to make tremendous reductions without restricting firearms. At the same time, when you look inside of Finland, the northern areas of Finland, where firearms are more common than the southern areas, have higher rates. Now, it may be due to other things. Mm-hmm. So this is a very complicated situation. You know, people are now talking about things like red flag laws, you know, which is take away someone's firearms if they're either a danger to self or to someone else. And you know, there's a little bit of evidence that this seems to work in Connecticut and out in the Midwest where it's been done, Indiana. And at the same time, you know, it's very clear that the biggest push in the United States is for locking guns in homes, you know, using a gun lock, using a gun safe. Now, if the owner of the key or the combination is the potentially suicidal person, this isn't going to work very well.
Right.
If you're trying to protect your kids, this might be very useful.
Yeah.
Right now in the United States, the most recent survey that I've seen from 2017 doesn't suggest that parents lock up guns the way they might when they have high-risk kids. But there are a lot of efforts out there now. There's a real effort through the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention and the Suicide Prevention Resource Center to promulgate really discussion approaches in emergency rooms, for example, so that when parents come with their suicidal kids, they actually talk about home safety.
Yeah.
Now, this might involve firearms. It might involve medications. It might involve other kinds of potentially lethal means. I think what's happening in the United States is there's a push to encourage sort of safety and caring. Whether this will affect people in the middle years versus kids remains to be seen.
Now, what do you hope your colleagues across the country will do?
Well, I think it works at multiple levels. Clearly in primary care, clearly in mental health settings, courts, for example, where people come in. The court is an interesting public health system because a lot of people in distress come through the courts. So in those kinds of settings, we would want to see a higher index of suspicion, a higher willingness to intervene before someone's suicidal when things are a mess. That's a technical medical term. When things are a mess, but not yet ready to explode or where they don't die.
Yeah.
CDC, for example, which is trying to take more of a role in suicide research and suicide prevention, needs the kind of funding coming from Congress that it doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something called the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, and they don't have the funding to do the kinds of large-scale studies that need to be done. You know, this has come up. It came up in President Obama's budget. It came up, I think, in the current budget. I don't know what the current budget deliberations are. To really try to fund larger-scale studies, you know, I don't know what the House and the Senate are going to do this year relative to the funding requests from CDC. But clearly, this is a very, very important area. Obviously, we've got to walk up to the firearm safety issue in terms of discussion. You know, the Second Amendment is the Second Amendment. You know, we're not going to the Supreme Court tomorrow and changing what the Supreme Court said in 2008. So we've got to find a way of having a national discussion which is sensible around how do we protect people's lives. You know, people often talk about home invasion being a reason to have a firearm at home. But we know that suicide in the home and accidents in the home from firearms far outnumber any instance of home invasion. Well, home invasion is very rare. So it's really clear that the country's got to get into a kind of process where eventually we can have some sort of, what do we call it, alignment of values and action. And it has to be both bottom up and top down. But for us who are clinicians and who I train residents and other things, and for those of us who work day to day in this field, we've got to really be attentive to the idea, like asymptomatic hypertension or elevated triglycerides. We don't have to wait till someone's grabbing their chest or needs a stent or is going into congestive failure to say that it's time to intervene. That philosophy exists in so many parts of medicine now, but hasn't really penetrated the mental health field so much. And that's really a thing that has to change.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Kane, for taking the time to discuss this with me today.
You're welcome.
That was our 231st Clinical Conversation. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these things. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.